Okay, well, I'm a bit tethered to the keyboard here because that's how I'm going to advance my slides, but I have about 33 slides, and it'll probably go about an hour, and then we can have some questions. I eat, sleep, and drink this stuff. So for people like me who do this all the time, this is a really great time in our country because healthcare reform only comes around every so often, and right now we're in the thick of it. So it's great, and it's just fortuitous that the Democratic National Convention is going on this week. I don't know if any of you have had time to watch it. There hasn't been a lot about healthcare per se so far, but it's exciting. So what I'm going to do tonight is give you a little background to our healthcare system, just a tiny little primer on why now healthcare reform has resurfaced, because it hasn't been around for the last 16 years. Then I'm going to walk you through the different platforms of the candidates, ask you some questions, and then hopefully we can open up and have a discussion. Okay? All right, so first of all, I'm going to talk about why now. Why is healthcare reform on the national agenda now? Who says what the presidential candidates are saying they would like to do to change our healthcare system? How's it playing with the voters? Obviously, if we don't have a pushback from the body politic, we're not going to get anywhere. And then, are we there yet? The name of my talk. Are we there yet? Are we there yet nationally? Are we there yet historically? Are we ready for some kind of national healthcare reform? Okay, so why is healthcare reform on the national agenda now? Well, I teach a class each semester on healthcare policy over in the Department of Public Health Sciences, and my students always accuse me of being very critical of the healthcare system. And so I will say as a disclaimer that when we break apart the reasons why we're looking at change, it often is to address what we might see as a deficiency. And there are some real problems in our healthcare system. First of all, it's extremely expensive. I don't know if you know how much we spend on healthcare in this country, but last year we spent over $2 trillion. That comes to about $7,000 every man, woman, and child in this country. If you extrapolate it out even further, it comes out to about over $50,000 a second. So if you hear people saying that, oh, well, we really shouldn't talk about money when we're talking about medicine and care for our patients, it's too late. Many health policy experts believe that a lot of what we do in healthcare is either unnecessary, inappropriate, or wasteful. I think if you ask any medical resident on the ward, they would tell you about all sorts of things they see that are redundant. They don't seem to work very well. We have a lot of inefficiency in our system, and some experts say it is as high as 30%. 20% of Americans spend more than 10% of their income on medical bills. That's a red flag for a health policy expert, because once you reach that threshold, it usually means you don't have enough money to spend on other things that you need, your mortgage, food, education, things like that. And yet almost one out of five of us spend more than that on our health care. Medical bills is the number two reason for personal bankruptcy in this country. So I have a slide a little bit later that I'll talk about that more. And our administrative costs are three times higher than other countries that have a more centralized system. Now, when I say that, I'm not saying I'm advocating a centralized system, I'm just telling you why our healthcare system is so expensive. We have some real quality problems as well. Quality in healthcare, I have a slide I give my students, I call it the Zen of quality, and that is, you know, there's this thing, if a tree falls in the forest and nobody hears it, does it make a sound? Well, the Zen of quality is, if you've got all these quality programs going on in our healthcare sector and nobody really cares or nothing really changes, do we really have a quality improvement program in our healthcare system. So quality is kind of the stepsister, but it's huge, huge. It's very, very important because we spend a ton of money, $11 billion a year last year in hospital-acquired infections, 90,000 deaths. It didn't have to be. These are hospital-acquired. This means they got them after they went into the hospital. They didn't start with it. They're sort of invisible. You don't see it. Right now in our healthcare system, it's sort of a black box. And inside that black box, we don't know what goes on very much unless you happen to be a patient with an advocate as a family member, or you know what's going on, or you're in the medical profession. But most of us have this tremendous trust when we enter the healthcare system that things are going to be done right, things will be done well, and that we'll be well taken care of. And often that's true. And more we're finding that there are that things go wrong. The more you can do, the more things can go wrong. That's why in the quality area of healthcare today, we're trying to overlay on it a systems approach, much more of a process engineering approach with feedback loops and redundancies and checklists so that we can anticipate problems before they happen. But it's a very young science. It kind of pushes up against the culture of medicine, and there are a lot of problems right now. Despite the fact we spend so much money in our healthcare system, American adults and children in this country, only about 50% get the recommended care that they need. Oftentimes it translates into things like flu shots if you're over the age of 60. But it also has to do with things like screenings and immunizations, eye exams if you're a diabetic, taking a beta blocker after a heart attack. So it runs the gamut from medical acute care, post-acute care, to chronic care management, to preventive care. That's a quality problem, too. We often don't think about quality problems as not doing enough, or maybe even doing too much, but in each case, it's considered a quality issue. Tremendous variation in practice patterns. I have medical residents that do health policy electives with me on a one-month basis, and just today we were having our first journal club, and I was asking them about how their attendings on the wards use different kinds of expensive medicines. And their response was, oh, well, you know, we have some attendings who, if we're in the MICU and they think it's sort of futile care, they won't order it at all. But it's this very expensive drug for sepsis. But we have other attendings who want to use it on everybody all the time. And so, of course, my question to them is, well, do you know which one you should do? How do you know whether you should use it or you shouldn't use it? And of course, you know, when you're a resident, you're like, the only one lower than you is a medical student. So you don't ask, you don't doubt. But my job is to invite people to question. Okay, and it's inequitable. The Census Bureau just came out Tuesday with their annual report that everybody jumps on that looks at the number of the uninsured and poverty statistics. And what they found this in 2007 was that actually the number of the uninsured went down a little bit. But it's sort of it's a false kind of deflation, because what happened was everyone who gained health insurance gained it through a publicly financed program, specifically Medicaid and SCHIP. So we had fewer children who were uninsured because they were picked up by SCHIP because their parents became poor enough for them to become eligible. Because if you break out, if you look at the Census Bureau report, what you find is the percentage of Americans that get their health insurance where they work actually decreased a little bit, so fewer employers are offering health insurance, and the government programs are picking up more. That is something that happens typically when we're in a recession. We may not formally be in a recession, but we certainly are having economic problems right now in this country, and so as people lose jobs or they take lower paying jobs, their children, generally speaking, then become eligible for public health insurance, the children's health insurance program specifically. So you're seeing a shifting around. It doesn't. So the good, it's good news. There's only 46 million uninsured instead of 47 million uninsured, but they're more being carried by governmental health programs. We are the only country, the only developed country that has health insurance tied to where you work. For most of you, you probably don't even know that that's odd. But we instinctively, unconsciously, almost trade wages for benefits. When you go out, when you all go out to the job market, you'll be very marketable and you'll get good jobs, I hope. But you should ask, and I'm sure you will, you know, one of the questions will be, what is my benefit package? And the number one benefit everybody wants is health insurance. But it locks us to where we work. It means you can't take it with you. We do have something called HIPAA, which I'm sure you've probably studied about. And HIPAA lets you move from group plan to group plan if you don't have more than a 62-day gap. But other than that, where you get your health insurance usually depends on where you live and where you work. And that's very different than other countries. And so people who are self-employed, independent contractors, they don't have the same tax benefits or the same kinds of plans typically that large businesses can offer. It's regressive. There's a tax preference. Your health insurance has a tax exclusion, both what your employer pays on behalf of your premium as well as what the employee pays are taken out of pre-tax dollars, which lowers your taxable income, and that is a benefit that benefits higher income employees more than lower income employees because of marginal tax rates. So it's regressive. It means that it helps people who make more. So these are just some of the problems in our healthcare system. I use this triangle wherever I go because access, cost, and quality is often the way we kind of split apart when we talk about healthcare policy. They're all interconnected in very many ways, but if you talk about the uninsured, you're usually talking about access issues. If you're talking about the cost of pharmaceuticals or the cost of healthcare, we're in cost, and if we talk about things like medical errors, when I just talked about the hospital-acquired infections, we talked about quality, they all are connected, but we often talk about them in each of those points. Okay, so this map of the world tells us that the United States spends more of their gross domestic product on healthcare than any other developed country. We're the only one that is that dark, dark color. You'll see that in Germany, France, and Austria, and Switzerland, it's between 10 and 13%. Switzerland actually is the country that spends closest to us in gross domestic product. And even so, it's considerably less. Canada, Australia, I mean, you can read this as well as I. So we hold the distinction of spending more of our GDP, 16%, than any other country. And that's a good way to compare countries to countries. Is to look at how much of the economy goes towards healthcare. Now, all wealthy countries spend more on healthcare. Healthcare is what we call a super good. And by that, we mean that it's virtually, it's insatiable. We can always use more of it. And so the more money you have, the more money you're going to spend on it. And there's tons of stuff in the healthcare system that allows you to spend money on it. So it's not unusual that the United States, we're a wealthy country, would spend a lot of money on it. But the question to ask is, what are the opportunity costs? If we spend 16% of our economy on healthcare, what are we not spending it on? And if other countries spend less, what are they not getting that we have? Or conversely, what are we spending on and perhaps not being very efficient? And those are the questions that you need to ask, because in every resource allocation, there's never an unlimited amount of money, as you know. Okay, so this is a chart that basically says, based on what we spend on healthcare in this country, this trajectory, you would expect our life expectancy to be much higher. But as you see in this chart, our life expectancy is actually, on a population base, is actually lower than most industrialized countries who spend much less per capita on healthcare than we do. And there are many, many studies that suggest the reason for that is because, for all the reasons I just said in a couple of slides ago, that we're wasteful, that we don't get good value for the dollar, that we, you know, we overspend, we're not quite sure what's worth spending on, it's difficult to say no, all those reasons. And so, why does it matter that we spend so much money on healthcare? Well, part of the reason it matters is because the trickle down to the user being the patient, the consumer. If you look at this chart, you'll see that the red line is health insurance premiums. The bottom two lines have to do with workers' earnings and overall inflation, and you'll see that health insurance premiums have grown at a much faster rate than inflation or earnings. And what that does is create for purchasers, for employees, even employers and individuals, what we call a purchasing gap. If your wages don't keep up with the increase in premiums for health insurance, then your dollars can't go as far, obviously. And that creates a real economic burden for a lot of Americans. And so when I say that healthcare medical bills are the number two reason for personal bankruptcy, part of it is reflected in that chart. Since 2000, health insurance premiums have gone up 114%. You'll see compared to wages and inflation, it's much, much greater. And a study came out just this year that said that in 2007, 75 million adults under the age of 65 were either uninsured or underinsured. And remember, the underinsured has to do with this 10%. If you're spending more than 10% of your income, you're considered underinsured. So you'll see 4 out of 10 Americans are either uninsured or underinsured, which is really, when you think about who we are as a nation, that's a pretty disturbing figure. Healthcare is definitely an economic issue for families. This is a survey that was done by the Kaiser Family Foundation just this last spring, where they asked people, what are your serious economic issues facing you? Healthcare comes in third, but when you break it out by low-income families, it's the number two problem. So it is definitely most Americans, and this is really important as we go into the election, and we'll talk about this more because it's really all about the economy now. And Americans often don't think about healthcare as part of the economy, but when you ask them what are they having trouble paying for in their lives, they will tell you, I'm having trouble paying for my medications, I'm having trouble paying for my health insurance, I'm worried about health insurance going up at work, I'm worried that my boss is going to drop their plan, or I'm worried that we're going to go to a health savings account and a high deductible plan and I won't be able to, you know, on and on and on and on. So it is really an economic issue, even though people often rank it below that because in their minds they don't think of it that way, but they talk about it that way. Okay. With me so far? Right. So. So everybody believes there's a healthcare crisis going on. And but how you see it and what you want to do about it is really very different depending on where you sit. So as I mentioned before, this is a unique moment in history. At no time have two sitting senators faced off in a presidential election, and we know they are. We know that much. it's a half a century since either a president or vice presidential in office is not running, and no senator since JFK has been able to make the transition from senator to president. So it is an auspicious time. And for the first time in 15 years, both platforms have a healthcare policy reform agenda. And so that's what we're going to talk about. But before we talk about that, let's talk about the last time we tried to have national health care in this country, which was during President Clinton's first administration, and he was elected in 1992. He was in a recession. Inflation was high. Mortgage rates at that time were, I think, if not double digit, very high. And they had, when he was running, something called the War Room, where George Stephanopoulos would go and all the workers would go, and they had this big banner up in the War Room that said, "It's the economy, stupid." But his number two issue really was health care reform. And this is a great story. Let me tell you a really quick, tiny, little, funny, great, this is a great story. So, anybody here from Pennsylvania? Good. So, back in, I think it was 1990, Senator John Heinz of the Ketchup fame was killed in a helicopter accident. His helicopter, he was a senator from Pennsylvania, his helicopter actually went up, and unbeknownst to the helicopter operator, it flew into the bottom of an airplane. And it crashed and he died. The governor of Pennsylvania at that time was a Democrat. Senator Heinz was a Republican. And they had to hold a special election for that Senate seat. Now, Richard Thornburgh, who had been a previous, I think, Inspector General in a previous Republican administration, had a lot of visibility. He had served in Washington in an official capacity, and he was very popular. And it was a Republican seat that he was filling. So, but this Democratic governor had to find some kind soul to run against him for the Democratic Party. So he looked around, and who did he choose but Harris Wofford. Now, Harris Wofford worked with JFK in the Kennedy administration. He started the Peace Corps. And he, at the time, had just finished his tenure as president of Bryn Mawr College in Pennsylvania. And the governor asked Harris Wofford if he would run against Richard Thornburgh. And Harris Wofford said, "Yes, of course. I'll be a good public servant." He was just being trashed in the polls. I mean, 30 points behind. They made fun of his name. Nobody knew who he was. He was this little tiny man, this academic. He wasn't very charismatic. And he went to his doctor one day, and his doctor said to him, he said, "You know, in this country, people who are accused of committing crimes are believed to be innocent until proven guilty. And yet in our country, we don't have the same benefit for people who are sick. We don't presume that they deserve care. And I don't think that's right." So Harris Wofford decided to take that on as his campaign pledge, and he went on TV, and that's what he said. And it is the classic Cinderella story. He won. He ended up coming up from the polls, and he won. And then Governor Bill Clinton from Arkansas saw that going on and said, this may be a bellwether. This may tell us something that's going on nationally. So he took it on as one of his campaign pledges, and healthcare reform became an item. So anyway, back to the slide. So I thought it'd be instructive for us to look at what was the country like the last time we tried this? What were the pressures? Because it really has to be like a perfect storm. In order for any comprehensive policy initiative to get through Washington, you have got to have lots of pressure, and healthcare in particular, because you have so many stakeholders, and it is 1/6 of the economy. It's huge. So, So in the early 90s, there was a slower growth in health insurance premiums. Now, this time there is, and back then it was 14%. Now it's taking a bigger bite out of the economy, 16% as opposed to 12%. There are greater numbers of the uninsured. The uninsured numbers are growing faster. Unemployment rate is lower, and that's important because that's often seen as a pressure valve. Low unemployment often suggests a good, strong, healthy economy. Now, our unemployment rate is going up a little bit, but it's still pretty low, relatively speaking. I think it's around 5%. The federal deficit is bigger now. It was actually $368 billion in fiscal year 2008, and it's estimated to be over $400 billion in fiscal year 2009. So our federal deficit is actually larger now, which means that it's going to be harder to find new money. If you've got a big deficit, it's harder to raise taxes. It's harder to fund new governmental programs because you're trying to climb out of that hole. Equal level of dissatisfaction. Americans are always dissatisfied with their healthcare system. We have surveys that go back to the 60s. People are always dissatisfied with their current healthcare system, but nothing changes. More Americans now rank it as a top national concern. So that's now, then, and now. It's somewhat similar. Some parts are different. Why haven't we been able to have comprehensive health care reform in this country? Six different presidents have tried. It's interesting, you may not know, that Senator Clinton's plan in the early 90s was almost identical to President Clinton's plan was almost identical to President Nixon's plan 20 years earlier. And in each case, it didn't work. So it's not just red versus blue. Not just Democrats and Republicans. There's a lot more to it than that. Our political institutions are structurally biased against comprehensive reform. When our political institutions were set up, they were set up. Remember our history. We evolved because we felt oppressed by a monarchy. And so we wanted to make sure that we set our political institutions, we structured them in such a way that there'd be checks and balances. It is hardwired not to do anything major. Incrementalism is the sort of the way of the world structurally in this country. So it makes it very difficult to push things through. We also have a fairly weak executive. And we have a Congress. It's not like a parliamentary system. It's not like when the president comes in, everybody who agrees with him comes in too. We have a Congress who, even among the different parties, are different within each party. So every Democrat is not like the other, and every Republican is not like the other. So it makes it very difficult to get the votes and build the blocks in order to pass legislation. We're a huge country, 303 million people, and our states look very different. Utah spends 70% less on health care than Massachusetts does. It also has a much lower tax rate. It's very hard to find a one-size-fits-all when you're talking about health care reform. And when Stuart Butler's here talking to you, he will tell you more about that because he's a big advocate for letting states experiment and lead the way. There's a tremendous mistrust of the federal government in our country. When the Clinton plan was rolled out, there was a bumper sticker that said something like, you know, all the friendliness of the post office and the efficiency of the VA, or you know, something like that. So we mistrust large bureaucracies, and we are very anti-tax. And Americans, generally speaking, do not like income redistribution. They don't want to pay more taxes than they have to. We have a very basic fundamental ethos of individual responsibility, civil liberties. We focus much more on individual rights than we do on social solidarity or what we might call the greater good, the societal welfare. That predisposes us not to do big things nationally. Also, so a lot of cognitive dissonance on the part of Americans. You ask Americans, why does our health care cost so much? if you ask the health policy wonks, they will tell you again and again and again, well, it's because our prices are higher, we do more invasive, intensive procedures, we have more imaging machines, you know, it's technology, it's demand, you know. And if you ask the average American, why does our healthcare system cost so much? What do you think they say? Say, it's those damn insurance executives. They make too much money, they're just greedy. Or it's malpractice. Those are usually the two things they say. Or it's medical malpractice, you know, we're just being sued to death. And I don't want to get into a malpractice argument, which we can later if you want, but because it's a real issue and it's an important issue, but it isn't what's in the big $2 trillion pie. The malpractice is less than 2%, somewhere between 1% and 2%. So Americans have a lot of cognitive dissonance about what the problems are. Oh, yes, Americans say, we have terrible time. I think everybody should have health care. It's a shame that people don't have access to decent health care in this country. And 90%, 95%, 97%, you rephrase the question, would you be willing to pay X so that every American would be able to have health insurance? Those numbers come down. So it's that marginal benefit and cost. And so we have a lot of apathy. We vote less than any other industrialized country. There's a lot of cynicism. People get, and because healthcare is so personal, the way we feel about it generally has to do with our experience with it. It is so personal. I tell the physicians that I teach, you know, what other profession do you have your clients come to you and take their clothes off? It is so intimate, this relationship that you build with your healthcare provider. And so it's very hard to talk about it in terms of money. We don't ask to be sick most of the time. We can't change our biology. And yet, so people say, I don't think we should spend all this money in the last year of life. I don't think we should fund futile care. But obviously, all those rules go out the window when it's us or our loved one. So there's a lot of cognitive dissonance. It's expensive. Healthcare reform is not going to be cheap. There are dollars in the system that are circulating that we might be able to capture in some ways, but in order to do that, we're going to have to take out of somebody's pocket and put it in somebody else's. It's going to be politically very difficult to do. Again, stakeholders. So this was just a cartoon that came out during the Clinton era that sort of talks about, you know, as we talk about healthcare reform and we get down the road, all the stakeholders, it's really important that we all agree what this discussion is about, and it's really about money. So the healthcare maxim is every dollar spent or cut is someone's income. And if I could show you that pie, that $2 trillion pie, what you would see is 30% of it goes to hospitals, 25% of it goes to physicians, 10% goes to pharmaceuticals. And so if you're a legislator and you're looking at this, what you're going to try to go after what you can see. And that's why you see all the time things, and you see the physicians marching on Washington because Medicare payments are going to be cut. And it's everybody understands we have to shrink this pie because of all the spillover effects on people and it being so expensive and not being able to afford health care, employers dropping health insurance. Everybody understands there's a problem. But when it comes to who's going to give, that's where everyone says, well, let's do that. Let's not do that. Okay, so let's get down to the candidates. Senator Obama, the key elements of his plan are that employers would be required to offer health insurance to their employees or to pay into a public fund. We call that pay or play. Government would set up something very similar to what Massachusetts has done. Massachusetts calls it a connector, but what it really is a regulated, it would be like going to Sam's Club, And imagine Sam's Club had nothing but health insurance companies selling their plans, but they were regulated. So they all had to offer, you know, they all had to have like the seal of approval that they offered this and this and this and this. And in addition, what Senator Obama would recommend is that there be a freestanding public pool health insurance plan, much like Medicare is for over 65-year-olds now, so that people who don't have access to health insurance where they work could go and buy one of these private plans at the Sam's Club that had been, you know, regulated so that they all look kind of at least enough alike that you could choose among them. Or you could join the public plan. And what Senator Obama's plan provides is if it is more than 7.5% of your income, you would receive a subsidy. Remember I talked about that 10% threshold as being affordable. And that's the top. So if it was more than 7.5% of your income, you would receive a subsidy for that. Insurers would have to sell to everybody. This is called guaranteed renewal. And it means that if people want to buy health insurance, they have a pre-existing condition, they have a chronic illness, they have a family history of heart disease or diabetes, that means that insurers can't say no. They have to include you. The whole idea of insurance, as I'm sure you've learned, is that you pool. You get a lot of people in, so the people who need the service, that risk is amortized over the whole pool. It's more healthy. It doesn't matter if it's health insurance or life insurance or homeowners insurance or car insurance. That's the way insurance works. And so the bigger pool you have, the more people you'll have in it that can then compensate for the risk of the smaller number of group who will be using the services each year. So Senator Obama's idea is let's just make big pools. Let's make people have health insurance. He doesn't make people. He makes children. I'll get to that in a minute. But he said let's have employers participate. Let's try to form these big pools so we can stabilize our premiums and get more people insured. He would require a mandate that all children have health insurance, so parents would have to provide health insurance for their kids. If they were low-income families, they would receive a subsidy for that, just as I mentioned earlier in those pools. Okay, so I mentioned that. Senator McCain, on the other hand, is diametrically opposite. He thinks that we've got too much government regulation already, that if we just got out of the way and let the market work better, costs would come down, we'd interject more competition. The rules of market are that if you provide good information and substitutable goods, that people then can choose and buy what they want and not be forced to buy what they don't need. And what he would suggest doing is giving a refundable tax credit to every American, $2,500 for individuals, $5,000 for families. And it would replace the health insurance tax break, which I mentioned earlier was regressive. Basically, what Senator McCain would like to do is say, let's level the playing field. Whether you're unemployed, whether you're self-employed, whether you work for a small business, whatever, let's just give everybody the same break. Right now, if you're an independent contractor and you're buying your own health insurance, you don't get that tax preference. You don't have the privilege of buying it with pre-tax income. And what Senator McCain is saying is let's just give everybody the same benefit. So what he would do is actually make all health insurance taxable. He would give you a credit, but you would have to purchase it with after tax dollars. He also believes that health insurance would be less expensive if it was deregulated across state lines, so that if you found a health insurance plan in Maryland that you thought was more affordable, you could buy it. Right now, fully insured plans are regulated by the state, and you can't do that now. And there's the question of what are you going to do with people who insurance companies won't take? And he would set up high-risk pools at the state level for people who are uninsurable. And that's vague, but 34 states now currently have high insurance pools for people. I have a friend, just to give you an example, she retired early from her job. She was in her late 50s. She was using COBRA to extend health insurance, so she was paying into her group plan. You can do that for 18 months after you leave your job. She was diagnosed with breast cancer. She immediately became uninsurable because of her cancer. And fortunately, in Maryland, where she lives, they have a high-risk pool that she could buy into. But that is not true of all high-risk pools, and many high-risk pools in states have waiting lists that are years long. Senator McCain says, I like that model, and we're going to give more federal dollars, infuse more federal dollars in that to provide for those who can't get health insurance in the market because they have health problems. So Senator Obama's plan really wants more universal or near universal coverage using more government regulation, and Senator McCain believes more in controlling costs through the private sector using competition. Okay, this is just a little matrix that just shows you. I put in Senator Clinton there just because she was on the scene for so long, and just to show you that there really are very few differences between her plan and Senator Obama's plan, the only difference being that she would require an individual mandate that every American purchase health insurance. I mean, it's not an insignificant difference, but it's the difference between children only and employers and then requiring everybody. Okay, so Senator McCain and Senator Obama actually agree on many aspects of their health plans. They both have language about having more preventive services, increasing the use of electronic health records. We use them less than any other developed country. Giving consumers, patients, more information about cost and quality and price so they can become better consumers. Having more disease management and care coordination programs. We have a law in health policy called the 80-20 rule, and that is that 80% of all health care is used by 20% of the people. And a lot of those 20% are people who have multiple chronic illnesses, have many comorbidities. So if we all believe that if we could manage disease better, it would be less expensive and people would be much healthier. They both promote more options to purchase health insurance outside the workplace, and they both have subsidies. So, and they both support medical malpractice reform, although in very different ways. Senator McCain supports, as did President Bush, and passed House of Representatives twice, but never made it through the Senate, medical malpractice bill that would cap awards. Senator Obama's plan is more providing liability protection to physicians who document best practices. So, you might ask, what's the big deal? If they agree on so many things, what's the difference between the two of them? So, this is my mid-talk quiz. Which of the two candidates would change health insurance more as we know it? What do you think? Would it be Senator Obama? Would it be Senator McCain? What's your guess? Anybody want to take a stab?
Make them vote.
Okay. Who thinks Senator Obama's would change the way our healthcare system is run, or the way health insurance as we know it? How about Senator Obama? How many people think his plan is more transformational, revolutionary, whatever? Okay. Does that mean the rest of you think Senator McCain? Yeah?
I don't know, but I'm thinking it's a trick question, so I'm going to
McCain. You think I'm going to say nobody? Well, there is an answer, and the answer is Senator McCain. And I think most Americans would think it was Senator Obama. And the reason that Senator McCain's plan is so sort of revolutionary in a way is that it would completely change the way we built our private health insurance system. Our private health insurance system was built on the scaffold of employer-based health insurance that was received tax preferences. It started, it came out of the Second World War during wage and price controls. And what Senator McCain's plan would really do is it would, he explicitly believes that we should each purchase health insurance as individuals as opposed to blocks of employees or blocks of groups. And so what would probably happen is, it's hard to know, it's always hard to know what the unintended consequences are or even what the intended consequences are, but what would probably happen is without that tax preference, employers might not any longer offer health insurance. Employers hate offering health insurance. I mean, they want to recruit and retain the best employees, but it's a headache for them. Health insurance premiums are growing faster than their profit margins, and so it stagnates wages. They're constantly shopping in the marketplace for cheaper health insurance products so that they can afford. So without that tax preference, they would probably say, why should we do this? It is such a headache. I make widgets. I know nothing about health insurance. If that happened, then each individual American would be given $2,500 or $5,000 for a family to go to the open market and buy health insurance. Now, right now, a comprehensive health plan for an individual costs about $4,000, and that's if you get it through your employer. So that's a group rate. A family health insurance plan is about $12,000. So you're looking at people who have $5,000 tax credit and $2,500, and they have to make up the difference themselves in order to purchase it. Now, people may decide that it's worth it to them, and certainly Senator McCain feels like in this market approach, people should buy cheaper health insurance if they don't want to put more of their own dollars into it. But the fear by some is that for those who had been getting protection, an employer-based plan, right now working for the University of Virginia, you know, if I have diabetes, I don't, because I'm one of thousands of employees, I don't have to have a pre-employment physical, my insurance rate is not based on my health status because I'm in a big pool and it kind of washes, it all washes out. If I'm an individual, a woman in her mid-50s with a chronic illness and I go to the market to buy health insurance, I'm probably going to be uninsurable. So the fear is that there may be people who can't get insurance, that employers will no longer offer insurance, and that the kind of safety valve that Senator McCain is talking about may not be enough, or it may take too long, and that we'll end up not with just 46 million people uninsured, but scores more. But even beyond that, just the structure itself is very different than what we currently have. So Senator Obama, yes, wants more government intervention and regulation, but the structure itself would essentially stay the same. You'd have the regressive tax benefit, but people would continue to get health care, health insurance, the way they always have. Okay, so what do the voters think? This is looking back at previous presidential elections, and you'll see, just as we said before, it's always about the economy. Now, in 1996 and in 2000, we had a little problem with President Clinton. It's called Monica Lewinsky. And and people thought that the president probably should be held to a higher ethical or moral standard, and that was reflected in the exit polls. But the economy is right there. Healthcare usually is down a bit. And so that's fairly consistent. This is looking back again at previous elections, and you see that Americans have been kind of ambivalent about how they feel about how much we should change our healthcare system, whether we need drastic changes, whether we need to tweak it just a little bit. The most positive was in the late 80s when President Reagan was in office. People were pretty happy with their health care situation. And they were least happy in the early 90s, right before the Clinton health care plan, which is, of course, part of the reason it got so much momentum. And so the question we're asking today is, are we there again? But at that, since the early 80s is when we saw the most dissatisfaction. So you can see it spiked up there in the early 90s, but then it fell precipitously. And there are many reasons why the Clinton health care plan failed, and we don't have time to talk about them all tonight. This little picture in there was a Harry and Louise ad. Harry and Louise ad was an ad put together by the Health Insurance Association of America. That has been renamed now to AHIP, which is the Association of Health Insurance Plans. But basically, Harry and Louise was a very, very successful multi-million dollar ad campaign on the part of the insurance company where they had insurance industry where they had a middle-aged couple talking about how the president's plan would make their access to health care worse. And so I think it says up here, Hillary's health care plan forces everyone to buy insurance even if you can't afford it. And they would have these, they would be on television, and at the very end of each of these commercials, they both look right at you with the camera and they'd say, there's got to be a better way. And it was very, very, very successful. And what's so funny now is that you may be seeing this if you're watching television at all during the Democratic National Convention. I presume it'll be next week during the Republican. Harry and Louise has come back. But this time, Harry and Louise is being sponsored by a consortium of health advocacy groups called something like Divided We Fail. And it's just the opposite. Harry and Louise now are sitting around, they're a little older. They're now sitting around the kitchen table and they're saying like, you know, isn't it time we got everybody to sit down at the table and talk about how we're going to finally fix this? So we'll see if it's as successful as the first time around. Okay, so President Clinton, I remember watching him on TV in 1993. He held up this little card that was supposed to be your health security card. And he, basically said, before I leave office, we're going to fix this. And then, of course, it didn't happen. And then Willard Galen is a physician. He's a psychiatrist who writes about health policy. And basically, he bemoans that what could have been a national debate really devolved into policy quibbles. All right. So where are we now? I'm getting close to the end, so hang in with me. It's coming back up. You can see interest is coming back up again. David Wessel in the Wall Street Journal said debating the ailments of the American healthcare system is a chronic disease. But we're seeing, up and down, up and down. It's starting to come up again. This is a chart. It's very busy, I know, but it looks at where healthcare ranks with other issues that people think are important political issues. You'll see we kind of reached the peak in the fall of 2007. Healthcare reform was the number two rated political issue. But then, we have this little problem with gas prices and things and the houses all being foreclosed. And so it fell off and it's now falling below some others, so it's losing ground, unless viewed as part of the overall economy, as I mentioned before. So when you ask it in that way, what are you very worried about? It comes right up there. I'm really worried about having to pay more for my health insurance. This was a survey done with independent registered voters that everybody believes will be the swing voters in this election. Both the Republicans and the Democrats are fighting for this constituency of independents. Don't know if it'll translate into the voting booth, but that's just that. Okay, so I'm going to talk briefly about the philosophical divide because it's really important when you think about why, we've had six or seven attempts at national health care, nothing seems to happen. And when I say national health care, I don't mean single payer. necessarily. Germany has a national healthcare system, and it's actually a series of not-for-profit sickness funds that are run quasi-privately but are just regulated. I mean, a national system of healthcare that provides a way in for everybody to get health services. And you could say we have that in our country through our emergency departments, and we do, but it's a very imperfect, inefficient system. We know that the uninsured use about 50% of health services that the fully insured do. They die at a much higher rate. 22,000 people die a year because they lack health insurance, which translates means, you know, ability to get care that they need when they need it. Anyway, so where are we now? So are we there yet? Really depends on what you mean by there. What do you mean by there? You know, are we there? Well, where's there? Well, if you're a Republican, there means leveling the playing field, moving more towards a market economy, not having government regulations, not being forced to do something you don't want to do, not being told you have to have health insurance or how much you have to have it, don't want to become part of, be viewed as being part of the collective. They believe very strongly that individuals should determine how much health insurance they have, that they should take care of themselves and their families, that they don't want government handouts, and they don't think the government should hand out to some Americans and not other Americans. That's what there is to Republicans, and Senator McCain's plan echoes that to a large extent. If you're a Democrat, there is very different. There means that we ought to figure out a way to get people so into the healthcare system so they can have healthcare benefits. That getting good medical care is too important to treat as a commodity. It's not like shoes. It's not even like food. That it's special. That we're not prepared to let people die in the streets in this country, and so we ought to figure out a way to pay for it rationally. And that there should be this larger thing that we call the social compact, where everybody does their share, has an obligation in the name of mutual interdependence and responsibility. So you can see these are very big philosophical differences about what you think the healthcare system should reflect or provide incentives for or even require or not require. And that's reflected in how the health insurance would be structured. And that's really a lot about what this debate ends up being is, what do we mean by health insurance? And what the Democrats mean for the most part is not traditional insurance, because traditional insurance generally means you get insurance when something happens that's catastrophic. You buy homeowner's insurance because the tree is going to come fall on your roof. You don't expect it to, but in case it does, you're protected. What the Democrats believe is that our health insurance system should really be more of a medical payment system. That we're not going to wait until we show up with stage 4 cancer. But we really would, but we want to make sure people get screenings. We want to make sure they get colonoscopies and mammograms and pap smears and those kinds of things. That's a very different perspective than waiting until the catastrophe happens. The Republicans believe more in a traditional insurance structure. They think that people should be paying more out of pocket or that they should be able to set up health savings accounts that have some tax preferential means so that people know what they're spending. Right now, if you have health insurance and you have a $10 copayment or a $20 copayment, you have no clue how much anything costs. And so you tend to overspend or to use too much. We call that moral hazard. From a Republican perspective, it is, let's let people spend more on certain healthcare services, much like they would spend on other services, and they'll be more prudent purchasers. And we'll spend less because it's not like you're given a ticket to go into the all-you-can-eat buffet and you just gorge yourself because you can. That's the principle. But because of this divide, Congress has been gridlocked about this. They can't, it's so intractable that we just can't move it. We can't move it forward. So presidential leadership is really important. We really haven't had a president since President Clinton that wanted to move this issue. We may or may not now. Certainly Senator Obama seems to have more of a comprehensive agenda than Senator McCain, although Senator McCain has strong ideas about where he would like to take it. Getting healthcare reform in the national agenda is more than just getting the president, who may have it as one of their campaign platform issues. It's much more complicated than that. And so the first thing you have to do is try to remember this, because maybe after the election we'll be back together and we can talk about this. So the first thing that happens is you have the general election, and healthcare reform has got to come out through the exit polls as being a pretty important issue, or it won't have any political currency with the new president. So it's got to be well represented in exit polls. The momentum has got to be there in order for the next stage to happen. The next stage then is the president is elected, and there's kind of two ways it can go on this little decision tree. So if there isn't groundswell for change, then the president will probably punt. If he wants to do something in healthcare, they may try to do something small, like the Children's Health Insurance Program. Maybe they'll do something so that it looks like they're doing something about healthcare, but it won't be a big program. Or something will happen and they'll decide that it actually is a priority. That's what the Clintons did. They got past this stage and they said, we are going for the whole banana. Then there's Congress. So Congress then, so the president says, I'm taking this, I wanna make something, we gotta work together, I gotta work with the committees, we're gonna really try to get something going. And Congress can either say, no, we think those Democrats are such jerks, we hate everything they're about. Democrats could say, you Republicans, all you care about is making money and the rich, and you don't care about the little man. And as long as they're like this, they're not going to talk to each other, they're not going to work together, they're not going to reach across the aisle. This is what we've seen really for the last 16 years. Or maybe there's an appetite for some sort of centrist deal. And we don't know if this time will happen. This is, these are our last few Democratic presidents. You will see here that in two of the cases, healthcare reform was an important agenda item. President Johnson, this was Medicare and Medicaid, although Medicaid was really sort of an afterthought. It really was about Medicare. He got it through. President Clinton was not successful in getting his program through. If you look at this picture a little bit more, you'll see that some of the economic landscape was a little bit different. There was more economic growth during Johnson's period. During President Clinton's time, there was a recession. So there were some different indicators, but can you tell me what the biggest difference is and what probably had to do with why President Johnson was able to get his program through and President Clinton was not? It's really an unfair question, I know. It's a busy slide. The number of Democrats in the Senate. With Senate rules, you can't get anything out of the Senate unless you have 60 votes because of the filibuster. So when President Johnson was in power, he had 68 Democrats in the Senate. and they were able to get Medicare through. When President Clinton was in office, there were only 57 Democrats in the Senate, and he was never able to build a block with them. So that's important too, and we'll talk about that when we come back after the election and look at the composition in Congress to sort of then evaluate, well, what are these really hot button issues, will they be able to go forward? So the lesson of health reform politics, not policy, but politics, is getting reform on the national agenda does not mean it's going to pass necessarily. And just because everybody agrees there's a problem doesn't mean that everyone will agree on solutions. Even if the public seems to be in favor of it, it doesn't guarantee legislative victory. And the search for a technical solution to what is a political problem will never succeed. We may hate politics, we call it the art of the possible, but it is the glue that allows our system to work. And so if you opt out, then it will never change, because that's the way it works. That's what holds our political system together. Okay, last slide. So are we there yet? Is it even possible for the US to have meaningful health care reform? You know, we've had a long, hard struggle in this country to try to bring it about. Even if you don't believe in single payer or whatever, but to even have any kind of health care reform, even to do what Senator McCain wants to do, will be a monumental achievement in getting it passed and all of that. I don't know, has anybody seen Sicko? Well, Sicko is a propaganda film I tell my students. Michael Moore, obviously, if he were here, he would say the same thing. He doesn't make documentaries; he makes propaganda films because he wants to get his point across. Everything in that movie that he showed was true, but it isn't true of the whole system all the time. So you have to be careful. You have to kind of look at these things with a bit of a jaundiced eye, because it's all about balancing. But at the end of Sicko, there was a quote. And the quote was from de Tocqueville, the French philosopher who came and visited the United States and wrote about it. And he said, "The greatness of America lies not in being more enlightened than any other nation, but rather in her ability to repair her faults." So when I think about, is healthcare reform ever possible in this country, I like to think that as we evolve, we will figure this out. We'll figure out how to make this work so that we're true to our American ideals, and we also are compassionate enough so that people who need quality healthcare have access to it. So with that, I will leave you with this. There are only 68 days until the election, and I very much hope that you will vote. Thank you.
Understanding everything correctly, that a way to get rid of that really was coming up in any of the other parties' platforms.
Indirectly, yes, it's buried in there, but each of the candidates, but more Senator Obama, talks about, there's a kind of a buzzword in health policy now called comparative effectiveness. So in England, for example, they have what's called the NICE Institute. It's an acronym. It's the National Institute for Clinical Effectiveness. And basically, all new technologies come through there. And they have to pass a cost effectiveness before they're kind of released out and let for use. So the idea is, and this was in Senator Clinton's plan and Senator Obama's, and Senator McCain talks about it a little bit, would be an evaluation of new technologies so that they couldn't just all be disseminated without some technology review. The idea then being, if we know what works, I mentioned the sepsis medication in the NICU, if we knew what patients would benefit from it, then you could devise a clinical protocol which then could be adopted by payers like Medicare and private insurers, where they say, we're not going to pay if you, unless you document to us that you're going to use this drug on this patient and that this patient fits this, you know, fits the profile of the patient that benefits from it. So it's a long way down there, but that's the way they're starting. And even now, Medicare, starting this October, is will no longer pay for 11 what they call never events in hospitals for hospital-acquired infections. So the hospitals are like quaking, because right now CMS is not going to pay for pressure ulcers. They're not going to pay for urinary tract infections that happen in the hospital. They're not going to pay for if you operate on the wrong body part. And that's going to roll out this October. So that's where we're kind of going. But you're right. When you talk at this level on the stump, if you talk about that, Americans are like, yeah. it's too down. You know, they, you know, you got to keep it simple, stupid. People's attention spans are very short. Yes.
One of the major reasons that politicians seem to explain the disparity between U.S. costs and other countries' costs is the fact that other nationalized healthcare programs can use their purchasing power to bargain down prescription drug prices. And that seemed to not, you know, play a big part in the Bush prescription drug plan reform. It doesn't seem to be mentioned, you didn't mention it in either of the other two platforms. Is that the case, that Americans are indeed paying more for drug research or for drug prices, and is that going to be addressed?
Americans do pay. We pay more. Our prescription drug prices here are much higher than in other countries. We also have access to newer drugs sooner. Senator Obama's platform does recommend that the federal government be able to negotiate directly with the pharmaceutical industry for the Medicare prescription drug plan, which is explicitly in the Medicare Modernization Act, was explicitly written in that the government could not do that. It was sort of the pharmaceutical industry protection plan. And so Senator Obama would do that. Senator McCain is not in favor of that because it would be price controls. It's monopsony. If you get a huge enough purchaser, then you can dictate prices. But other countries do it in order to control those prices. What most people who are against price controls would say is that it will stifle innovation and it will cause us to ration, and you know, and that the reason other countries can ratchet down those prices or can ratchet down those healthcare costs is because they have longer waits for elective surgeries and those kinds of things. You know, when you measure things on a population base, their health outcomes are better than ours. But there are other things in life than whether you're dead or alive. You know, you can be in pain. You can be waiting for things. It's not easy. It's not easy to look at that and pull it apart. But that's what, when you distill it into, you know, this is why I don't want it. When you distill it into stereotypes, it comes down to rationing versus not rationing and the perceptions of those things. Did I answer your question okay? Yes.
In the Democratic primary, it seemed like the big issue between Clinton and Obama on the individual mandate was a matter of, do you control costs by ensuring, by mandating everyone, or do you expand coverage by financial costs? Is there a mean, was there, I guess, in your profession, more people come down on the Clinton side or the Obama side, or did it still kind of pop up in terms of the mandate being necessary?
I think that most health policy experts believe that unless and until you have an individual mandate, there will always be people who would be free riders. We know that in order for subsidies to be effective for people to voluntarily purchase health insurance, it has to approximate what the private sector offers, and that means that you have to subsidize it about up to 80%. Otherwise, people just often won't buy it unless they're sick, and then we call that adverse selection. If only sick people buy insurance, you can't get the pooling you need to spread the risk. So most experts think we got to get everybody in the pool. But I think Senator Obama's strategy is that individual mandates they're so undesirable. People keep thinking that they have to be told what to do, that people don't mind you telling your boss you have to do it. So, well, you know, we could probably, if his thing played out, we could probably get 30 million of the 45 million in through the employer mandate. And then the idea being that with the subsidies, you might get people to buy more, as we're seeing in Massachusetts. And then ultimately, I think it would move towards an individual mandate. I think that's kind of the way people see it.
Yeah. Would a move away from employer-provided health insurance decrease the bargaining power of health insurance purchasers by making them individuals instead of groups?
That's a good question. You would think yes, because an individual voice may not have the same clout as a human resource manager who is carrying thousands of enrolled lives. I think what the Republic, Senator McCain, feels like is that if the individual is the purchaser, then the health insurance industry will have to come up with more attractive products to meet the needs of the individual. I like part of Senator McCain's plan. I really like the idea of separating health insurance from where you work. I think it's terrible that when you change, you can't think about where you work, you can't think about leaving your job because you're worried about your health insurance. Wouldn't it make more sense to just have your little health insurance card and be able to take it with you wherever you work? But until we get a pooling mechanism and a way to get everybody in, which means that you don't discriminate because people are sick, if we can fix those pieces, I'm not against what he recommends, but there needs to be a pooling mechanism to spread the risk, and there need to be ways to protect people who have pre-existing conditions.
I think that's the last word.
Okay, thank you very much.